I'm Joe C. Mantle, and welcome to Raven Conversations. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, Colonel Craig Broyles. He's a fantastic LinkedIn follow. If you are not following him, I highly recommend it. He does share a lot of great stuff that's going on, not only in your organization, the 81st Brigade, but really just in general. I think you have a great social media presence there on LinkedIn, sir. Not to throw too much at you right now. He's here to share kind of his background, his time working at the at SAMS, the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies.
Yep.
I know if I didn't write that down, I would have butchered it. Your philosophy, fight outnumbered and win. I think that's a great way to kind of think about things, especially in today's military. And really just what's happening in your organization. So thanks for coming, sir, and joining us.
Hey, thanks for the invitation. I really like what you guys are doing here. I like your logo. I think it's great.
Yeah, so intro and background on yourself.
So I grew up in Southern Colorado in a small town. If you dialed the wrong number, you'd still talk for 15 minutes. I grew up on a cattle ranch. And I love to play football. So I went on my, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints. I went on my Mormon mission to Arkansas. My dad went to Thailand. My older brother went to Argentina. I went to Arkansas.
Why'd you go to Arkansas? They went to these great places.
They just tell you. So anyways, went to Arkansas, come back, and I want to play football. So I luckily got to play football at Idaho State University.
All right. Go Bengals. Go Bengals.
That's where I was. And met a you know, found a cute girl there. And anyway, we got married, and I was broke. So somebody told me about, I was trying to figure out how I was going to make some money and play football. Somebody told me, hey, do you know there's this unit that in the Army, and they sneak behind enemy lines, and they lace targets, and then aircraft comes in and blows them up. You could do that. And I was like, that's a thing?
That's fantastic.
I didn't even know anything about the National Guard. I'm like, that's a job? You're like, yeah, it's in the Army. I'm like, well, I don't have to. No, you do it. You can do it on a weekend. And I'm like, how can I? Really? Anyway, I bit hook, line, and sinker. What they were talking about, Colt teams, back in the combat observation lead teams, back when the,
wow,
because they're field artillery unit, yeah, there. So, I mean, I had this great NCO, Sergeant Penzel. He was tough, mean. It was everything I wanted to be in this life. So I did the National Guard, played football, and simultaneously there at Idaho State, they started an ROTC program. It was brand new. I was the first class to actually go through as ROTC. And so I thought, well, I'll do that. And so commission 9/11 happened. In fact, I was going to Spanish class when 9/11 happened, and I had 1 year till I graduated. So I went to ROTC, commissioned an active component in National Guard. I mean, in the active component in the infantry. Me and my wife, I had a little dude at the time, went to, at the time, Fort Benning, infantry school. Then I went to Ranger school right afterwards and went straight to Afghanistan. I finished Ranger school and went straight to, because the unit was already there. I went to Afghanistan, came back for a year, then went to Iraq. Again, this was with the 10th Mountain Division. And then Valerie and I decided to get off active duty. And at the time, who was hiring was the U.S. Border Patrol. So got on with the U.S. Border Patrol. I went to the southern border there in Casa Grande, just west of Tucson. Mm-hmm. I was on the dirt bike patrol. And also, I got in on this small teaching, small unit tactics for the Border Patrol, which is really probably one of the most formative experiences. I spent several years teaching small unit tactics at the Border Patrol and really shaped how I think about things. While I was there, a good friend of mine got seriously wounded in Iraq, and I had a lot of guilt because I felt I should have been on that deployment too. And so I told Valerie, let's go back active duty. And she goes, well, isn't there a National Guard unit here? And it happened. There was a light infantry battalion there in Arizona, the 158. So I contacted them, and they said, hey, you know, do you have any work for an out-of-work ex-captain? And they said, we would. So I joined the National Guard again, went to command at Alpha Company there in HHC. And then the Border Patrol has a pretty cool unit called a disrupt unit. They kind of do a lot of, you know, plainclothes kind of stuff. And I kept wanting to try to get into it, and I'd apply and apply and apply. And finally, I got accepted, but it was in Blaine, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So Valerie and I did a transfer to Blaine, Washington, and then that's kind of where I got in with the 81st. So I went to the Command and General Staff College in Washington. This is where I got introduced to SAMS. So I was in, if you go to the Command and General Staff College, you have the thing they call the Big Blue Bedroom, and because that's where everyone goes to sleep. It's all, yeah, the majors go to listen to a lecture and they fall asleep. So I was in there, and they start out with bringing in people, hey, there's a program you can do. You can get your master's degree here. You can do it and all that. And this one guy comes in, and boy, just, you know, buzz cut and, you know, really uptight, and looked at the crowd, and he's like, I'm the director for the School of Advanced Military Studies. I don't even know why I'm up here. Probably none of you have the academic ability to even get in my course. Most of you apply. Probably none of you will get in. But if you would want to apply, here's how to do it. And I remember bumping the guy next to me, goes, what is SAMS? And the guy's like, that's a school of advanced military studies, man. I'm like, so? I'm like, well, I'll apply for that. So I really kind of applied out of spite. Anyway, I don't even know how, because later on I did the enrollment. I mean, I was the one that interviewed people for applicants. I still can't believe I got accepted, but I got accepted. So spent a year at SAMS, and that was probably, SAMS is the best way to compare it is you watch The Wizard of Oz, and you see behind the curtain, that's really what it is. It was like one of those things where you take the red pill and you tumble down the rabbit hole. I didn't even know that stuff existed. Like, you know, you read Doctrine or you read Millet, but I had no idea how little, I was ashamed of myself that I knew so little about my profession. And I became a fanatic. I wanted to learn about warfare. I want to learn about theory. I want to learn about, I was ashamed of myself, how little I knew. Thankfully, after I left SAMS, you're supposed to do a utilization tour. And that's just when the Associate Unit Pilot Program with 7th Infantry Division across the road started. And fortunately, I was picked to go and be the exchange officer. So I spent 2 years at 7th ID, where I was the Assistant Chief of War Plans, or the Deputy Chief G5. And I learned, you know, National Guard officers usually don't get to work at the division level. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the Corps, and I did Pacific Pathways, and, you know, like we're doing Raven Focus coming up. That's where I kind of learned it, as I kind of mirrored what they did over there. Finished that, and then it just so happened I was able to command the Dark Rifles, which was one of the greatest experiences of my life. You know, and then I commanded Dark Rifles, went to NTC, went to Poland. I just came back. And then for my war college, SAMS has a war college equivalent. So I went there, and I spent a year at the SAMS equivalent of War College. And then the second year, I actually taught SAMS. So this last year, I was an instructor. Once I was the learner, now I am the master. And so I had my own majors that I could, and I wanted them to fully understand how they should be ashamed of themselves, of how little they know about their profession. And that's where I really, you know, I am forever grateful for my journey in the National Guard. It has been the most rewarding experience. And I think about myself, you know, the other day when the tag, when he was retiring, General Doherty, and he says, you know, the purpose of life is to have a purpose. And as I look back, I have had, you know, I couldn't have had a better career. And so, you know, here commanding the Cascade Rifles, it's great. And so then I really just see the purpose of my life is just really trying to, leader development is what I'm all about.
Yeah. So you kind of gave us the answer for the question I'm going to ask, but what was that introduction to the Guard? It sounds like it was already like kind of laid in stone when you were like, hey, I need money for college. Like,
yeah, well, and it was, you know, I just got married and, you know, my wife was trying to work to support me and I was playing football and my cultural background growing up where it is, you know, that was kind of, that just didn't sit well with me. My wife was supporting me and my football habit. So at first, and then someone told me about this cool job. I didn't even know there was like what the National Guard was about. You know, you had to act, you know, have a part-time force and all that. And man, yeah, I bit. And I had great NCOs at the time, and I've been surrounded by great people ever since. So that was my introduction to it.
Yeah. What was your position in football?
I was linebacker.
Linebacker. Yep. So this kind of goes to that philosophy that I think you're carrying right now, and that's that fight outnumbered to win. Linebackers usually are very outnumbered right at the line, yeah. Right in the seven. Yeah. So kind of talk about that philosophy. What does that philosophy mean?
So at SAMS, we got introduced to a lot of different things. And one of the things you do is you read the air, land, battle doctrine. So right now we do multi-domain operations. Well, that really kind of comes from air, land, battle, 1983 and 86. And when I read it, and in doing so, the goal was, it was actually, General Perkins talked about, it had to be six syllables. And fight outnumbered and win was six. and for some reason, I don't know when I heard that, it was so intriguing to me because I remember thinking, well, how do you do it? How does someone really fight outnumbered and you win? And then as I thought about it, this is a really intriguing question. And I realized that everybody struggles with that question because almost everybody is outnumbered. And it doesn't take a lot of brain power to beat somebody when you overmatch them. And for me, that's just always been a thing. And then I really got introduced to, during SAMS, I got introduced to maneuver warfare theory. And I, in this past year, I spent the year teaching with a guy named Jim Greer, who's without a doubt one of the most smartest human beings ever. And he's a maneuver warfare, you know, zealot. And that question always comes back, fight outnumbered and win. And what, you know, what I realize is, you know, for example, when the dark rifles went into Seattle during the riots, we were incredibly outnumbered. When we went to Poland, when we were defending the Suwalki Gap, should that had actually, you know, the Russians invaded, we'd have been incredibly outnumbered. And I'm absolutely convinced that no matter, you know, the 81st, where we go next, one thing I'm certain of, we will be outnumbered. Mm-hmm. And we, our expectation is, our brigade is what we're for, is, you know, upon notification, we deploy anywhere in the world, we have, you know, fight upon arrival, and we win. But we're going to be outnumbered. So, you know, that's something I always think about all the time, is how we do it. So that's kind of been my emphasis, is, you know, the 81st Striker Brigade, we got to fight, outnumbered, and win.
Yeah.
So how do we do it?
Yeah. So that's a great philosophy. And you kind of touched on Poland right now. And for those that don't know, so when Colonel Broyles was the commander of 3rd Battalion, one of the 161, the Dark Rifles Infantry Battalion, you took that battalion to Poland as part of a NATO mission. Really, you know, I don't think we have fully talked about that mission. I know we have in bits and pieces. From your standpoint as a commander, what could you share with that?
Well, if you look on the map and you look in eastern Poland, you'll see there's a little corridor. And if you're watching, you'll maybe interested, pull up your Google Maps and go to eastern Poland. You'll see there's a little corridor there. It's 45 kilometers between Belarus and Kaliningrad. And Kaliningrad is kind of the Russian equivalent of Hawaii. You know, it's just separated just by a little bit. But there's 45 mm-hmm. kilometers that separate. What's important is in between that gap is a highway. I think it's Highway 8. And all of the truck, all the supplies that go to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, mm-hmm. all those supplies have to go on that road. And if you drive it, it is full of trucks. I mean, just backwards. So if you're, you know, if anything needs to get there meaningfully, it's got to go up that road. If Russia was to cut that gap, then all of those three NATO allies would wither, because all of their supplies are now cut, and they have to come up by the ocean or mm-hmm. some other way. I mean, it would strangle them. Everyone's really sensitive of that. So what NATO did is, and I think that the philosophy is, how, you know, getting everyone to buy in the fight. You know, there's all these separate countries. How do you unify them in this fight? Well, with a NATO battle group, they take a NATO battle group is what they call a task force. You put them over there, and in that battle group, you fill it with different nations. So in my battle group, I had a reconnaissance troop of British. I had an anti-aircraft battery of Romanians. They had this Gepard. It was like being in the Millennium Falcon. It has these four cannons, and it spins real fast.
Oh, wow.
It's wicked cool. I had a MLRS, rocket launchers from Croatia. And then you have the United States. And so therefore is, if Russia, so they put them forward. So we were sitting in the Suwalki Gap. And the philosophy is, if Russia was to attack and they run into battle group Poland, well, they're not just running into America. They're running into Great Britain. Mm-hmm. They're running into, you know, Estonia. I mean, no, they're running into Croatia. They're running in Romania. And that just would really galvanize the support there. And our mission was to defend that particular gap alongside with our Polish allies. The thing that I think was really, you know, I there's many things I learned, but this one I thought was meaningfully, is, you know, when I grew up in the global war on terror, and the global war on terror, you know, we were forward, we were in a, you know, a lot of these towns, and you, because of the situation, you were at best, you know, you look at the local population, you were always suspicious. You always had to be careful. You always had, you know, every road you went down, you were waiting to get blown up or ambushed or something of that nature. And so our relationship with the locals was probably, you know, it was a lot built on suspicion, and the FOBs are kind of situated to be, you know, I had this attitude of it. And so I think that endures. And when I went to Poland, it took me a little bit to shake off that, one, the Poles are super pro-American. I mean, I've never seen so much American patriotism in the Poles. To see how unified they were with how close they were to their nation being, you know, wiped off. And the civilian population were not just agnostic. They were super supportive. And that was really cool. And I think what people need to remember about war fighting is, context is everything. And, you know, in the future war, you know, will the population help you? They might. Well, yeah. They'll be supportive. They might, you know what I mean? And instead of always thinking the population's adversarial, we kind of built this whole kind of way of thinking that the population is not to, well, we'll never help you. They'll always hurt you. They'll harm you. And that's not always the case. And
yeah,
context is everything.
Yeah. I mean, and those relationships are critically important, those NATO relationships. And you kind of speak firsthand about, it wasn't just Americans. It was British. It was Polish. It was German. It was everybody kind of coming together.
Yeah.
So that kind of also, you know, we look at, we're outnumbered maybe, but when you kind of bring the whole together, we don't become outnumbered anymore.
100%. And, you know, the Poles, they're good. I mean, they're really good. I think there's a kind of a habit, you know, in America, we go to an exercise, we go to something and we kind of, you know, say we're, you know, stronger together and we'll grab our ally and kind of put them in a chokehold. Let me show you how to do it kind of thing. I think it's our tendency. Not that it's bad, but I think it just comes from kind of where we've been. We typically fight in kind of third world places. You know, we've been to Somalia and you go to Iraq and Afghanistan where there's a lot of us in the front. You go to Poland, that's not that way. They're really good.
Yeah.
They're really good and they're really professional and they really know what they're doing. And that was really cool to be around a force like that.
Yeah. So then after that deployment, you had the chance to go back and teach at SAMS.
Yep.
I imagine that experience kind of helped in what you were teaching. Really, for those that don't know, how does one go about applying for SAMS? How do they get into it? And then what to expect?
Well, so first, what SAMS is. So SAMS is the graduate level education to teach operational art. So then like, well, what is operational art?
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere down the line, someone decided that, you know, America was great at tactics, but we're not very good at campaigning. So I like to use karate belts because I think it's an easy way to comprehend things. So a white belt, blue belt, and black belt. So the white belt of thinking about operational art is basically it is echelon specific. So corps fight operational art, you know, combatant commands fight operational art, divisions, and now brigades have tactics, you know, and then like the Secretary of Defense, they would come up with a strategy. So you kind of, it's the bridge, but you have strategy, and then you have, you know, operational art, and then you have tactics. Okay, well, that's fascinating. Well, the kind of the blue belt way of thinking is about campaigning. And what people have trying to come to understand is, you know, in times of past, you fight a big battle and it's over. You fight a big war and it's over. Everyone wins, goes home. Well, those are no longer the case. You'll see that in Ukraine right now. There's lots of battles being fought, but it hasn't decided anything. So you got to think of in terms of campaigning. Campaigns, the operational level of war wins wars.
Mm-hmm.
That's the campaign. Just like, you know, here the Seattle Seahawks, they're going to want to have a set of campaign together to win the Super Bowl. So each game, if you think of a battle, well, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But there's more to that. Is how do you string together your wins? How do you do free agency? How do you do your manage your injuries? And there's all these things that kind of have this orchestra that has to happen to string everything together. And that campaign will get you to the Super Bowl. So that's kind of the blue belt way of thinking of it. The black belt way of thinking of it is, you know, post Vietnam, a lot of the generals were unhappy with the political meddling that was going on in warfare. And so there was an appetite. Could you ever have a political free realm to fight wars? Could that ever occur? And so what they've done, or I don't know, it's this kind of, like I said, the I guess the expert way to think of it, the operational level war is supposed to be, is it truly? Probably not, but it's supposed to be like the realm where you win wars that is almost free from political meddling. So the politics and strategy are kind of involved. Then the generals get their realm to win the war in the operational level. Then the tactics is where you fight the battles. So what SAMS is the 1980s, they realized they need to stand up a school to teach just how to plan for operational planning, how to teach a major to go to a corps, to go to a combatant command, and to be a planner for campaigning. And they thought it took different skills than a tactician.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where SAMS comes from. And so in order to really do well at the operational level, you have to be a master tactician. So what they do at SAMS is they break it into kind of blocks. And so the first block, you learn all about theory. And we're not just talking war theory. We're talking about how people think, how you think. It goes early into sociology, a lot in philosophy, and a lot just different things of just how does humanity think? Gets into biases. And, you know, we read the book, you know, about, you know, you read tons of it. They call it the Book a Day Club. but they really expose you to how people think. Once you finish that, then you really go into, okay, U.S. Army doctrine, and how does the Army look at, and really what doctrine is, people get, you know, I think in the force there's a lot of doctrine anxiety, you, especially with the National Guard officers. They don't like to read it. They don't apply it because their experience with it is some field gray just fillets them in front of everyone for misusing it. But what it means, basic it is theory, is history, and you go into history. History is what happened. The theory is why it happened that way. And doctrine is, well, how do we get it right now? And that's really, so you really spend a lot of time going to doctrine and then the history, and they kind of show you how doctrine came about. And you go back into like the Napoleonic times, you move up through, you know, the Mexican War, you go up to the Civil War, and you actually do a staff ride, you go down to Vicksburg, and they show you how Grant strung together battles to win Vicksburg. And then you keep it kind of going, and then, you know, with history, doctrine, then you get in design. And design really is the SAMS planner's weapon system. So, you know, a soldier has a machine gun, a SAMS planner has a design. And what, and they teach design because your design is you create something that's needed that does not exist. So how do you create something that's needed and not, that, that does not exist? And that's what a campaign is. So when a general says, hey, we need to win this war, you're creating something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And then finally you get into the future of warfare, and that's the course.
Yeah. See, in that history piece, for any field grades that are listening to this and they haven't gone to ILE, you're going to ask yourself, why am I doing history? Why do I care about this? And I think you just gave the exact answer that our instructors gave us during ILE, is this is why we do history, because you have to learn from what's been done in the past.
And I, you know, and what you'll realize is there are human tendencies. Now, things don't happen the same way. In fact, I keep telling all my officers, you know, when you arrange a battle, the way I like to arrange, you know, a phase of operation now is you have the preparation phase, you have the initiation phase, then you have the adaptation phase. And that gets this idea that every battle takes on a life of its own. And most of the time, people will always go back to what worked before. And if you understand that every battle will take on a life of its own, you have such an advantage. Now, but that doesn't say history is important. But what you'll find is human have tendencies. Mm-hmm. They'll try to rerun the same thing. And if you are well educated and, real, and you know, you really understand this, you'll understand tendencies. And you know, I talked about when I taught small unit attacks in the Border Patrol. This was meaningful to me, probably the probably most meaningful way I think about fighting, because when I taught tactics in the border, it was based on two agents who had gotten surrounded by some Mexican cartel, and they both got shot, and they were in a prolonged deadly force encounter, like 45 minutes in a gunfight, which is unique in law enforcement. Usually it happened very fast, but this one was a long time. So the whole tactics course is trying to help Border Patrol agents learn how to survive and win in a prolonged deadly gunfight. Mm. And so I put together this program and I taught it both in Arizona and Washington. And what I learned is people do the same thing almost every time. And I learned as I taught it, and we did a lot of scenario-based training, I've learned that when you get behind somebody, and they, when their focus is front and you get behind somebody, they cognitively lose it. They come undone. I saw it over and over and over again. So bring that forward with history, you'll see that if you can identify the tendencies, you'll see that humans will do the same thing a lot of the time. Plus, you then you merge that with an understanding that every fight will take on a life of its own. Now you're getting how to fight outnumbered and win.
Yeah.
Because you have a distinct advantage over other people who don't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic message. And I appreciate you sharing kind of your philosophy on that one, sir. Kind of leads me to your new unit. You took over the brigade in June. You guys are currently in the cycle for XCTC. Talk about what is going on. What's moving? What's going on right now in the brigade? What's moving forward for the brigade look like?
Yeah, so we're scheduled to go to the National Training Center in August of 2026, which is the Super Bowl. One of the things I think happens is soldiers, you know, they spend a lot of time shooting. They spend a lot of time, you know, doing medical treatment. They do a lot of, you know, individual skills, but they never see how it all fits together. And I think that is the great value of why soldiers go to the National Training Center. You will see how your ability to shoot, your ability to communicate, your ability to move, your ability to, you know, do to treat soldiers, your ability to do maintenance. It's not just a standalone thing. It makes the entire machine work. And you don't, it's like when you spend all your time blocking and tackling, but you never watch the game. And when you see the whole game come together, it's great. And here's your opportunity to compete. And I love that it's competitive. So here's our opportunity to really fight as a brigade, to everyone's skills come together in a unified way, and we can, you know, I call it the musicians from Mars, right? We're going to make war music, not noise. Now, to get there, you typically spend, so we have 2 years to get there. So the first year up, what we're getting toward is this July of 25, we're doing Raven Focus. So we're going to focus on getting Raven ready to go and win at the National Training Center. So what the National Guard Bureau pays is a scrimmage. So we get one scrimmage, get ready. This will be our annual training in July. It'll be in Yakima, and that'll be, and we're going to treat it just like NTC. It's going to be a full-on, we're going to have black team versus gold team. And it's going to start platoon, company, and we're going to end with a big NTC-like scrimmage. It's going to be great. And then we'll finish that, and then we'll get ready, and we'll, you know, get our live fires completed, and then we'll show up to NTC, and then, man, we're going to do great.
Yeah. And you've had the chance to go through NTC as a battalion commander. What's kind of your expectations as a brigade commander? Just the same, but with in a larger footprint?
My expectation is the hardest thing, bar none, is to get everyone to play together. It is, the riflemen will do great. When last time we went there, our squads, quote, this, I'm going to have this written on my tombstone when I die because I was so proud. The OCTs told us we had the best rifle squads they had ever seen. And I mean, could a battalion commander love a compliment like that more? I mean, I've never lost that, you know. So I have 100% confidence in our squad leaders and our soldiers that, you know, they'll do, you know, our maintenance was the top of anybody. In fact, I got phone calls later on that NTC rotation asking me how we did our maintenance. But our soldiers are great, and I have no doubt in their capability. What was hard for me was getting everybody to play together, because it's super hard. And I think a lot of it is because there's no unifying concept how you fight. Mm-hmm. And so what I tell the brigade is, you know, if you're on active duty, one thing I know for about active duty for sure, and if you're watching from active duty, tell me if I'm wrong. I think the Ranger Regiment is a little different, but everyone else, not the Ranger Regiment. They will all, every unit I've been in active duty, they all have a TACSOP, tactical SOP. They will never follow it. They won't even know where it is. And it'll probably be that thick, and No one has read it. And then they'll realize when they go to the National Training Center, they'll say, well, is that in your TACSOP? Oh, yeah. And then they'll realize how important a TACSOP is. They'll update it right afterwards and then shelve it and never look at it again. And then we'll just wash, rinse, and repeat. So I, you know, that's going to be my dying breath, is follow the TACSOP. I mean, I'm going to, we're building our playbook. I call it a playbook because that's what you run plays. And we're going to follow it. We're going to know it, and we're going to refine it, and we're going to get good at it, just like a football team. And I tell all my officers, look, what makes you think if you got drafted to the Seattle Seahawks, you went up there right now, the first thing at hand you would be what?
A playbook.
Their playbook. Mm-hmm. Go to their first practice and not know it. Yeah, watch what happens to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't last. You'd be cut.
You'd be cut that day.
Probably that day. Show up that first time. Why do we think we're different? Why do you think we can just go and just make things up and be ad hoc? We don't meet together enough to even think we can just make things up as we go.
Yeah.
So I am absolutely convinced that winning or losing resides on a team play. And team play only can occur if everybody understands what everybody else is doing and everybody's working together. And you have to do that. You got to have like plays.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what we're doing.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing constantly is it's the same thing. It's some of the football analogies, but they all work together. It's the team. It's the team. This is no different. It's all part of a team. The Washington National Guard and 81st Brigade is a team. And you're kind of preaching that. You're bringing that message to it.
Well, and it's a great team. I tell you, I've been in a lot of organizations, dude. I've been all over the place. And I'm not ashamed to say that I love the Washington National Guard. They've got the greatest people here. I mean, General Sellers, the guy's great. He's great. I'd go to war with that guy any moment. You know, Matt James, the previous commander, what a great guy. You know, Chief of Staff, Marshall, I mean, all these people that I work around, I love them. And that's a rare thing. And, you know, the soldiers don't realize what great leadership they have. Now, I mean, is there a problem? Of course there are. Nothing's, you know, hard to be flawless. But I tell you, everybody here really cares, and they're passionate about it. And I love being part of the Washington National Guards, and that's why I came back. This is why I'm part of it.
And that's why your son's here now, too.
And my son is, yeah. My son joined the Washington National Guard. He's an infantryman in 3rd Battalion. He's actually down there teaching pre-ranger at Fort Moore. And I love that he's part of it because I like the people around. It's a winning team. And it's a rare thing, man, because you don't find that everywhere. And I've been a lot of places, been on losing teams, both football teams and organizations losing teams. And when I found this place, I was like, that's it. I want to be a part of this and contribute meaningfully until, you know, until the day that they chase me out. But I tell you, people don't know how good they have it. They don't know what great NCOs they have here, what great officers they have. I mean, Command Sergeant Major Richardson, great dude. I mean, our Brigade Sergeant Major, Sergeant Major Gibbons, that guy would do anything for any soldier. I've seen him do it. So I can just go on and on, but I'm telling you, this is a great organization, and I am proud as hell to be a part of it.
No, it's great. Kind of my last question, we'll keep it lighthearted. Any football memories of being on the field?
I do. So my favorite memory, I was playing Northern Arizona, and I was covering a punt. So I ran down to go cover a punt, and as I was running down, I saw the guy catch the punt, and just he started running to the right, and just as I went to hit him, a guy came in and blindsided me. And I heard the crowd go, "Ooh!" And I was the recipient of the, "Ooh!" And I remember seeing the lights as I flipped. I hit the ground, and I knew I had the wind knocked out of me. And if you ever had the wind knocked out of you, you have a couple moments before you go into the dying sequence, I call it. You think you're going to die. And I really didn't want him standing over me and taunting me, or, you know, I wanted to get off the field and then go, not then be embarrassed as I went into the dying sequence. So with my last ounce of effort, I jumped up and I ran to the sideline. When I hit the sideline, that's when the dying sequence started. I couldn't catch my breath. You know, I was in pain. And finally, after a while, I finally caught that breath, and somebody poked me and said, "Hey, dude, I think you're supposed to be over there." I had run over to the Northern Arizona sideline. So in my effort not to embarrass myself, I even doubled down on that experience by running to the Northern Arizona sideline. Luckily, the defense was on the field, I think, and I just kind of moseyed out there and just, you know, kind of acted like I knew what I was doing. But, A little embarrassing.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on, sir, and joining
great.
Us
Thanks for having
and
me.
Sharing your message. I think it's a positive message. It's a fantastic message. Truly, I think fighting outnumbered and win, that's a great catchphrase, I think, for the brigade, and you're sharing that philosophy everywhere.
Yeah, great.
If you like the video, give it a like. If you want to know more, throw a question in the comments and subscribe for future videos. And sir, we appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks.
You.
Appreciate it.